This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bocave, in for Terry Gross. Writer Pat Conroy made his father famous, but not for the traits a father would want to be famous for. In the novel The Great Santini, Conroy presented a fictionalized version of his dad, a Marine Corps pilot who disciplined his wife and children with verbal abuse and violence. In the film adaptation of The Great Santini, the father was played by Robert Duvall. Conroy went to the military college, the Citadel, and wrote a fictionalized account of the harsh discipline he encountered there in his novel, The Lords of Discipline. Last year, Terry spoke with him about his memoir called My Losing Season that includes the real version of some events he's fictionalized. It focuses on his years at the Citadel when he played for the school's basketball team, the Bulldogs, and was coached by a man nearly as authoritarian as his father. My Losing Season is just out in paperback. Here's a short reading.
Because I grew up a complete stranger to myself, I did not even seem to catch a glimpse of a determined young man who developed in secret during college. I do not recognize the intense stranger who stares back at me in photographs faded and frayed around the edges. My coaches, throughout my youth, all approved of me because my attitude was upbeat and fiery, my enthusiasm contagious, and I gave everything I had. I liked that part of me also, but had no idea where it came from. As a boy, I had constructed a shell for myself so impenetrable that I have been trying to write my way out of it for over 30 years, and even now I fear I have barely cracked its veneer. It is as rouged and polished and burnished as a specialized glass of telescopes, and it kept me hidden from the appraising eyes of the outside world long into manhood. But most of all, it kept me hidden and safe from myself. No outsider I have ever met has struck me with the strangeness I encounter when I try to discover the deepest mysteries of the boy I once was. Several times in my life I have gone crazy, and I could not even begin to tell you why. The sadness collapses me from the inside out, and I have to follow the thing through until it finishes with me. It never happened to me when I was playing basketball, because basketball was the only thing that granted me a complete and sublime congruence and oneness with the world. I found a joy, unrecapturable beyond the realm of speech or language, and I lost myself in the pure, dazzling majesty of my sweet, swift game.
Pat Conroy reading from his new memoir, My Losing Season. At the Citadel, you played for a losing team. You write that you learned a lot from losing. What are some of the things you learned from losing?
Well, it's the thing that has always been a theory of mine that does not sit very well in America is I don't think you learn anything from winning. You know, you just jump up and down. It's wonderful. It's fabulous. It's glorious. You're happy. Your coach is happy. Your school is happy. But losing, there's a deeper music in loss. There really is something about losing that you have to figure out what you did wrong. You have to change the way you played. You have to look at yourself in a different sort of way. Losing seemed to prepare me for life. Bad reviews. My mother dying. There was nothing about my mother's death that reminded me anything about winning. But it did remind me of how I felt whenever we lost.
You had a coach who worked the players really hard and could be very negative when working you.
Terry, very good. I think you read him correctly.
tell us about his style.
Coach Mel Thompson was a great rebounder and player from North Carolina State. He was coached himself by the great Everett Case, who brought was with Adolph Rupp, was one of the guys that brought basketball to the South. Everett Case was famous for being tough on his players, and Mel Thompson was as tough as any man I have ever met. And he was on us from the time we began practice to the time he blew the whistle for practice to be over. He was the kind of man that was, I think, very common, certainly in my childhood, and I think certainly in the 50s and 60s, where he simply, I think in a Bobby Knight sort of way, simply screaming was an art form with him. And I think eventually the breaking of his team's heart was what he did. He did not meant to be. He just simply coached the way he was coached. And I think a lot of people did that back then.
What do you mean by the breaking of his team's hearts?
I think Coach Thompson, eventually, the boys that he broke on my team were the boys with real talent, not boys like me. And Coach Thompson, to me, was a much milder version of my father.
Mm-hmm.
Coach Thompson yelled at me all day long. He didn't hit me, so I ended up loving him.
He didn't hit you because you were used to a devil far worse in your father?
Yes. Dad was the toughest man I've ever met. Mel Thompson ranked second.
What were some of the things the coach would yell at you? What were some of the things he'd say for you?
They don't want to hear this on National Public Radio, Terry.
Give us the clean version.
Let's see. The clean version is, okay, you guys are women. Women. You guys play like women. Women. The lowest thing on earth. Women. And it was variations on that theme. You know, we were weaklings. We were cowards. We didn't want it enough. Oh, we couldn't do it. You know, did we have no manhood? Do we have no pride? And there was a variation of that theme that began in October and ended in February.
You write in your book that you learned to substitute your voice for his voice so that your voice would be in your head instead of his voice.
I was afraid of Coach Thompson, and I was intimidated by Coach Thompson. So what I had to do, and I had to learn, and this was valuable for later on in my writing life, I had to listen to my voice. I had to find confidence by listening to me because I could not find it listening to him. Coach Thompson did not inspire confidence. He inspired terror. And until I could listen to myself and ignore his voice, I did not come into my own as a basketball player.
How did you learn how to block out his voice with your own?
It was in the locker room during the Loyola game, during halftime. I was not starting, and the team had a meltdown. And Coach Thompson, who was a heroic, how should I put this? He could take you apart verbally at halftime of a basketball game better than anyone I've ever seen. He, on this night, it was mythic. He simply came apart. He was flinging chairs all over the locker room. He was screaming that our team was nothing. We didn't care. We had no pride. Played like women. Magnificent profanity. And I looked around the room, and I saw my team, and they all had their head in their hands. And I realized my team had been broken. My team had been broken not by the other team, but by their coach. So I sort of heard a voice inside me saying, you can't listen to this guy. He's not good for you, pal. And the voice shocked me at first because my family produces schizophrenia like some families produce freckles. But it was a voice. It was clear, and it was solid. And I worried about schizophrenia except for this. The voice was giving me good advice. This was a voice I could trust. It startled me because it sounded like my father's voice. And I did not recognize it at first as my own voice, and what I later called my writer's voice, the one I listen to, the one that brings me good news, gives good advice, uses sound judgment. And it was the first time that this had ever happened because in my childhood, and look at this boyhood I lived, Terry, the great Santini, the Catholic Church, the American South, the Citadel Plebe system, and Mel Thompson. No one had a male-dominated childhood like I did that ever lived upon this planet. And until this voice appeared, I was a very docile, obedient cadet. I did not get in trouble. I was not a hood. I was not a gang member. I did not smoke dope. I did not drink. I simply towed the line of my very disciplined childhood. Until this night, I had never heard my own voice say anything.
Now, your team was a losing team. What holds a losing team together? I mean, what's...
Nothing.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely nothing. The reason I wrote this book is I was sitting in Books and Company in Dayton, Ohio, a city I'd never been to, nor had I ever wanted to go to. But I was sitting there at the end of a book signing, and I looked up and I saw my ex-teammate, John DeBross. And I had not seen John in 30 years. And he and I had played guard together. I looked up and I said, DeBross, you ever been in a bookstore before? He turned to me and said, once, Conroy, I was lost. And he finally said, Conroy, my wife and kids don't believe I know you. Would you come to my house and meet them? I've been telling them I've known you for all these years, and I haven't seen you in 30 years. So we were driving out into the suburbs of Dayton, Ohio. And John started talking. It was like this: the locker room came alive, sprang alive, and I had not thought of it for all these many years. And DeBross, who's very competitive, said, I was better than you, Conroy. I was a lot better basketball player. And I said, you certainly were, John, and you proved that every single day. And he started talking about the team and where they'd gone. I realized our team had scattered to the four winds. So none of us had kept up with each other, that we were all strangers to ourselves. We had not invited each other to our weddings, our christenings. I had no idea the names of any of my teammates' children. They did not know the names of mine. So as we were going out there, DeBross said, Conroy, do you remember the last game of your career? I said, I certainly do, John, but I would never have mentioned it to you. It must be very painful to you. And John had missed a layup against the University of Richmond in the Southern Conference tournament. If he'd made that layup, we would have beaten them and gone on to play West Virginia the next day. But John, who never missed layups, missed this one in the most important moment of his life as a basketball player. And Richmond went on to beat us in overtime by 2 points. And John looked at me and we went to the next light. He stopped. And John, not an emotional man, not a touchy-feely man like I am, looks over at me and he says, Conroy, I want you to know this. I did not miss that shot on purpose. I said, John, anybody that knows you knows that. He says, our coach didn't. I think Mel Thompson thinks I missed it on purpose to get him fired. And then John grabs me by the wrist and tells me, Conroy, I think missing that shot partially ruined my life. And Terry, words like that get my attention.
Really?
And I began going back, having no idea that year had touched anybody except me so completely, so totally, and so unforgettably. So this book is a result of that moment.
Now, you played at a military college through your career, the Citadel. How do you think basketball at the Citadel compared with basketball at other schools in the league that you played?
The other schools were much better. There's a problem about playing in a military school as an athlete, and all athletes at all military schools, West Point, the Naval Academy included. Athletes are not liked by the other cadets.
Yeah, you say that in the book, and I couldn't figure out why, because, in so many schools, the athletes are the heroes, or at least in certain circles, they're the heroes. And you say that they're second-class citizens in military schools.
But not in military schools. We are sometimes loathed because we get out of parade, we get out of inspection on Saturday morning, we get out of drills. Even though we're down there practicing 3 hours, the Corps never sees that, so they don't appreciate that. And, one of the things that my teammates are still bitter about is they come across alumni who said, oh, you're an athlete. You didn't really go through the system.
Were there teams you played with a more street approach to playing basketball that you were unprepared for?
This was the time in the South before integration. One thing that still I laugh about every time I see is a picture of my team. It's all white. And, of course, basketball now is a black game, a city game, an in-your-face game. And it's changed completely since I was down there. And when I was there at the Citadel, it was still in the South a white boys game. And that has changed completely. Now, what I loved was how the game was played in the ghetto. And I grew up following my father in Washington, D.C., and I learned to play with black kids. And I love to drive. I love to take it to the hoop. I love fast. I love behind-the-back passes, through-the-legs dribbling. And I was early to that game, Terry.
But you couldn't play that game at the Citadel?
Well, I played it after the New Orleans game. I started it the rest of the season. And I found myself as a basketball player. My father and mother came to see me play my first college game. We played East Carolina. And all I remember from that game, I don't remember being at East Carolina. I don't remember a single thing about the game. I remember that after we lost, the manager came up to me and said, your dad's outside. He wants to see you. So still in my sweaty uniform, I walked outside. And I remember this part exactly. My father put his hand up on my chest, pushed me against a cinder block wall. And he said, and you have to translate this, son, your crap
your team's crap, your coach's crap, and you couldn't hold a candle to me on the best day of your life. I said, we didn't have a very good day, game, Dad. Can I go out and see Mom? Negative. We got to get back to D.C. My surprise, Terry, was when I went back to the game and looked at the box score. I discovered I had scored 25 points in that game, more than anybody on either team, and I was the smallest guy on the court.
You had a father who didn't know how to take pride in a son's accomplishments. He only knew how to be competitive with a son.
My father was simply overwhelming in that. I mean, I think I could have been an All-American. I could not have satisfied him. At the end of the year, I won two awards. I won the Sportsmanship Award, which I always won, no matter what the school I was at. My father hated it. He loathed it. And he said, ah, the Chicken Award. My boy always wins the Chicken Award. But the other award was more difficult for my father. I won the Most Valuable Player Award of this team I wrote about. Now, me winning the Most Valuable Player Award on this team says much about the team and our fate. When I asked the players to rate the players by their skills as a basketball player, I ranked 11th of the 12 players. So the fact that I won the Most Valuable Player shows how much this team fell apart. And it seemed almost a mockery to me that I walked the world as the MVP of a team where we had so much better basketball players than I was.
Now, you know, the coach gave a quote about you to the local paper. Pat Conroy gave another great performance. That kid gets more mileage out of his talent than any player I have ever coached. Now, on the one hand, that's a great quote. He's saying you get more mileage out of your talent. On the other hand, I couldn't help but wonder, is he saying he gets more mileage out of a small talent?
That's exactly what it was. With Coach Thompson, when he gives you a compliment, there's always another side to it.
Yeah.
And what he was saying is I was no good. But I overcame that somehow. And, and I knew what he was saying, but I still took it as one of the greatest compliments of my entire life. And I think later on in there, I tell my children, my heirs, I said, put that on my tombstone. Put what Mel Thompson said about me after my last game on my tombstone. That's what I want there.
Part of your story is about your father, who you've written about in other books as well, fictionalized, particularly in The Great Santini. And you write, in my life as a writer, each day, I bring the ruined, terrorized boy I was as a child and set him trembling on my desk so I can study the wreckage of myself at leisure. Why, as a writer, do you want to keep returning to that terrorized boy that you were?
Because I cannot get that terrorized boy to leave me alone. He haunts me. In this book, I tell about my father as he was. I tell the story of my life with Dad. It always shocks me. The story always gets to me. Several years ago, Penn had a special thing at, Folger Library in Washington. And they asked writers to come up with their first memories. And I remember Eudora Welty, her first memory of sunshine on her face, and Reynolds Price, a goat, ate his diaper off him. And I remember all these wonderful, fabulous first memories. Then I get up and give mine. I'm sitting there in a high chair in El Toro, California. And my mother is trying to stab my father with a butcher knife.
Hey.
And my father is laughing and is beating her to the floor as I'm sitting there in my diapers watching this scene. And that was the first thing I remember. And that was Welcome to the World, Pat. And that was the world I inhabited until I was 21 years old.
Now, your father died in 1998 of colon cancer. What was it like for you watching The Great Santini, watching this really strong-willed, violent man who abused his family, watching him get really weak?
Well, it was heartbreaking. It was in the last months of his life. I was trying to think of a way to make it better for Dad, to make it easier for him as he was dying. So what I did was I interviewed Dad over his whole life. And I said I was writing a book called The Death of the Great Santini. And Dad said, great title, son. You know how to make someone feel really good. But Dad had changed when The Great Santini came out. There had been a sea change in my father. he was horrified by the portrait I had painted of him. And when he and I talked about it, I said, Dad, I'm sorry I hurt your feelings, but there's nothing you can do to make up for my ruined childhood. But here's what Dad did. He became a good man. He became a good guy. All six of his children who were still alive, we could not believe we were weeping at his funeral. Right before he died, and a couple of days before he died, he still was the same guy. I mean, he did not, you know, there was that basic core of Santini that never changed. My sister, the poet in New York, Carol, came down from New York, and we had shifts. His dad was dying in my sister Kathy's house. And I went over there one day, and I heard screaming from the outside. I'm half deaf now, Terry, so I don't hear screaming very often. So I heard screaming. I went in, and so I got closer and closer. It was Carol screaming at my father, Dad, you've got to tell me you love me, Dad. You got to tell me you're proud of me before you die. You just have to, Dad. So I motioned to Carol to come into the next room, and I said, Carol, that is Don Conroy dying in there. It is not Bill Cosby. And Carol said, he's never told me he loved me. He's never told me he's proud of me. I said, he's never told me that either, Carol. But he sends you money every month, Carol. That's Dad. That's how he says I love you. He brags about you to me and your poetry. He always used to love this, Terry. He would brag. He'd always tell me, he says, you know, your sister is a much better writer than your son. I said, thanks, Dad. I appreciate it. And poetry is a much higher art form, son, than prose. Did you know that? I said, well, thank you very much, Dad. And I prefer your sister's poetry to your writing. She says in 5 words what you say in 5,000. I said, thank you very much, Dad. I said, now, Dad, will you do me a favor? Would you name me one poem that Carol has ever written? And Dad just roared with laughter. But on this day, I was trying to tell Carol that Dad had different ways of saying he loved us. He couldn't tell us that directly. Anyway, I give this to you. Calm Carol down. We go back in, and Dad would be dead in 2 days. And as we go back in, my brother-in-law, Bobby Joe Harvey, who calls himself the family redneck, and for good reason calls himself the family redneck, and he lives up to the name. Bobby Joe is coming in to cut Dad's hair, cut his fingernails, doing something. And as Bobby Joe comes in, Carol and I are sitting in chairs around the room. And my father opens his eyes, sees Bobby Joe, and says, and I quote, Terry, I love you, Bobby Joe. I'm proud of you, Bobby Joe. And Carol went off like a Roman candle. But that was the Santini's old humor and old malice at work to the very end.
Did he ever, like, really get the fact that you were wildly more successful than he ever was? You know, after all the years of him putting you down and telling you that your basketball game could never be as good as his and that you could never be a man like him and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Did he ever realize, I mean, really get how successful you were?
I don't know. You know, Dad, here's what Dad never became. Son, I'd like to have a talk with you heart to heart. You know, he never did anything like that with me. And I would have to interpret Dad. The thing that I treasure most about Dad and my career was after The Great Santini, a book he hated, but he loved the movie. And my father thinks he made Robert Duvall's career. He thinks he is fully responsible for Robert Duvall's career. But when The Great Santini came out, Dad, I remember coming to Rich's department store in Atlanta, and he was still, his feelings were still hurt, he was still brittle, he was still, his mother, my grandmother, never spoke to me again. And his family had gone nuts when the book came out. So I'm sitting there signing, and the next thing I knew, somebody had come up to my father and asked him to sign the book. So my father signed it. I hope you enjoy my son's work of fiction, the underlined fiction, you know, 10 times, and he said, and he then signed it, Old Lovable Likeable, The Great Santini. And it started something that became habitual in my father's life. Whenever I had an autographing, he would sit beside me, and he would autograph the book. And I think it's the only time in American history that a father and a son sat and signed books together. And, you know, what I loved about it is he would be saying, Dad was slower than I was. He was much more elaborate, and he was charming. His second half of his life, his charm came out, which I never saw once in the first half of his life. And he would sit schmoozing and talking and laughing and enjoying himself. And then he would look up, and he'd look over at me, and he says, my lines longer, son.
In the very beginning of your memoir, My Losing Season, you write, I grew up a complete stranger to myself. Once you became an adult, I think you've lived a life of very complete introspection, both through therapy and through writing, because so much of your writing has been autobiographical fiction. And I guess I'm wondering about going from that one extreme of being a complete stranger to yourself to the other extreme of this regimen of therapy and introspective writing.
You know, I don't know how that is going to end up. I was surprised when I went back into this childhood again. You know, it took me by surprise. But I realized I never told the whole truth about it. My father was extraordinarily hard on me and extraordinarily hard on his family. In turn, I have been extraordinarily harsh with myself. In this book, I think I was after a task. The one thing I've never done for myself is like myself very much. And I think I went back to this book because I needed to fall in love with a boy I once was. But as I was writing this book, I was going, what a boy. This kid's something. Here this kid is coming out of this ridiculous family. He wants to be a writer. He's a cadet. He's on the honor court. He takes everything seriously. He tries to be a good member of the Citadel community. And I started admiring the kid. I just started admiring him. I thought, you know, this kid's doing the best he can under arduous circumstances. And I think that was my task in this book. I needed to like myself for the first time.
Is this book a memoir instead of fiction because your father's dead?
Well, I think it is. I do not think I could have written it when Dad was dead. I found this out by accident when I wrote an introduction for a book called Military Brats by Mary Wirch. My father did not mind it as much when I called him Bull Meacham, or as he said, when I made him a shrimper in The Prince of Tides, or I made him a drunk judge in Beach Music. I said, Dad, you couldn't catch a shrimp in a Long John Silver's. Give me a break. But my father said something that I thought was great literary criticism. He said, son, you will never be able to write the word father without my image coming up. And the father will never be an easy word for you because my face will loom up. And my father's right. You know, father is a damaged word with me. When I wrote this thing, for an introduction for Mary Wirch's book, it shocked me because I wrote the words that in my youth, I thought Don Conroy would one day kill me. And my father went berserk when I used his name. And he did not mind me using Bull Meacham or Great Santini because he could say that as fiction. But when I used the word Don Conroy, I was using his name and I was talking about him, and there was no place for him to run and hide when I, you know, just said who it was.
I think it's really lucky, probably, that that you feel your father changed as he got older and that you had a much more decent relationship. You had a good relationship with your children, so that you have another way of thinking of him and you're not continuing your life after his death with nothing but hatred in your heart for him.
Yes, I was lucky. I adored Dad when he died, and my father knew it. And I think I wrote to Great Santini. I think I've lived my life for this. I thought I wrote to Great Santini because I hated my father. And I realized later that I wrote it because I needed to love him. I needed a father to love. And I think it's a human need and a human wish. And I had it as strong as anybody. So I think I forced my father to become a good man and a good father.
Pat Conroy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Pat Conroy's memoir is My Losing Season.